Everybody, welcome back to another episode. We are your internet historians, and in today's episode, we will be discussing the history behind the movie Catch Me If You Can. Frank Abagnale Jr. worked as a doctor, a lawyer, and as a co-pilot for a major airline, all before his 18th birthday. A master of deception, he was also a brilliant forger whose skill gave him his first real claim to fame. At the age of 17, Frank Abagnale Jr. became the most successful bank robber in the history of the United States. FBI agent Carl Hannity makes it his prime mission to capture Frank and bring him to justice, but Frank is always one step ahead of him. But yeah, guys, what'd you guys think of this movie?
I loved it.
I did too. I mean, like,
it was a really good movie.
Leo, I didn't think he was cute in Titanic or in Romeo and Juliet, but I thought he was damn fine in this movie. Even as a little kid, I was like, this is what beauty is. So I've seen this movie like a million and two times solely for Leo, and and so I've always liked this movie, but this most recent time I was like, I feel like they kind of, you know, took us the story a little too far here or there, like I just can't believe this was real here or there, you know. But other than that, I mean, I think it's still a pretty good movie after how old is it now?
Almost 20 years old.
Yeah,
I'm like 10, 15,
19 years old.
But yeah, I mean, I liked it too. I just felt like it was a little bit too long.
You did?
I disagree for once.
I don't know why. I was like, there's, because it was like 2 hours long, wasn't it?
2 hours, 20 minutes. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know why. Maybe it's just like the slower parts. I was just like, okay, come on. Like, I don't know. There were some parts where I was just like, okay, I want to get to like the action. I guess like the running away scenes and stuff like that. So I don't know. I just thought those parts were a little bit too long for me. And I was like, they could have made it like, I don't know, maybe like 30 minutes shorter or something. Like,
yeah, I guess.
And like,
you're right.
I don't know. Like, and like for some reason to me, like the ending scene too, where he was caught and then he like escaped and then was caught again, like that also seemed kind of, I don't know, a little bit too long. It's like, you don't need two capture scenes. And then, yeah, that was just like, whatever. And then like, I thought that after that it was going to be over, but then it was like, it kept going. And I was like, okay, now we're getting into like whatever happened after. But yeah, I mean, I guess that's my only complaint, I guess. I liked it too, but yeah, I was just like, okay, this could be a little bit, but then again, I was also watching it like later at night after I got home from work. So I think I was just wanting to also go to bed. So I was just like, come on, let's get this over with so I can go to sleep. But
if you thought that was long, I wonder what the Broadway musical is like, because I bet that's even longer.
Yeah, I didn't even realize twice as long.
Yeah, when I saw it, I didn't realize they had a musical for it until I was doing the research, and I was like, oh, what the hell?
Yeah, it did okay.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Yeah, I think I saw in the article, too, that, yeah, it wasn't as popular of a musical.
Yeah. I had never seen this movie. I mean, I'd heard about it a million times because people liked it so much, but I don't know, for some reason was just never on my radar, but I really liked it.
It's your good pal Steven.
You're right. Steven? Yeah. Me and Steven.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which I didn't even realize. I don't know. For some reason in my brain, it doesn't really seem like a Spielberg movie to me. I don't know why. It just doesn't seem, I don't know, big enough, I guess. I don't know. But I mean, had a million people in it, because what else is new with a Spielberg movie? Which I was just like, oh my God, they're in it and they're in it. But I probably had like the strongest like reaction while watching this, like the whole time. I was very stressed. I was like yelling at the TV because I was just like, no way. I can't believe, like, I was just like, oh my gosh, this guy.
Especially because he was so young when he was doing all this stuff. And I kept forgetting that, because like in the beginning of the film, he definitely looked younger, Leo DiCaprio. Mm-hmm. And then as it progressed, it looked like, to me, I was like, is this happening over the course of like many, many years? Because then he eventually started to look older in the film to me. Like in the beginning, they made him look really, really young. And then so that's why I was kind of like this. Yeah. And so then, but then when I looked, it was like, oh, all like he was 17 or whatever. And I was just like, in the film, he looked like he got older. After, yeah, like I don't know, it seemed like it happened over the course of many years for some reason to me.
Like, I thought the same thing, and I actually started reading the book so I could like,
oh really,
part of
you and your books.
Yeah, I know, you always go on about
I know it's internet historians, but I got the book on the internet, okay.
Well, I was gonna say that from my research in real life, like his hair started to gray, so he kind of just played that up into making him look more mature, and they definitely did make him look, I would say, like more tired and like more exhausted throughout the movie, which is understandable.
Yeah,
always looking over your shoulder
in the film too, you know, he was like getting with all these girls or whatever. I was like, dang, how old are all these women if this was like in real life where he was like doing all these things and he was like 17. I'm like, what?
Yeah. That, dude, my biggest thing is like, I wonder if any of these women, like, or even friends, associates that like he was with watched the movie and was like, what? Like, I know him. And like the girl was like, I slept with him, you know, and I was 27 and he told me he was 28, you know, whatever. But yeah, like I really truly wish there was like one person who was like, yeah, me and Frank were pals and then he disappeared and, you know, 20 years later I see him in this movie, you know.
But I mean, I was watching an interview with him. It was on like 60 Minutes Australia.
Oh, I saw that.
The real Frank Abagnale. And he was talking about how like hurt people were that he like knew when he was keeping up this charade, and how they're just like, well, if we were so close, why didn't you tell me who you really were, type of a thing. Like, well, we weren't that close that you could have told me. So it's just like they were like very hurt that he wasn't, you know, real with them. So there were people that like did know him and like found out that it wasn't him, or it wasn't who he said he was this whole time. And I think it sounds like they probably were just like, excuse you, and like dumped him and were just like over it.
That's just funny though, because it's like they're mad at him for not that he was doing all these crimes, but that he didn't tell them that he was doing all these crimes.
I mean,
funny.
Yeah, like I don't know, I also understand Frank's point of view, like it's a crime what he's doing, like you don't want to tell everybody, hey guys, I've committed a crime. Did you watch
$1 million?
Did any of you guys watch the Google talk he did? It was an hour
too, but then I saw it was an hour long, and I didn't watch it.
So essentially it's like the same as the 60 minute one, because I watched the Google one first and then I watched the 60 minute one, and he like when he talks about some of the stuff, it's like the same speech over again, which is fine. Like
that's, you know, how most interviews are. I'm like, have you seen one? They're all kind of the same. They say the same shit over and over again.
Yeah. The only difference with the Google one is that he does say like maybe a little bit more of his background, and then he answers questions. I liked it a lot. I was just really impressed by Frank. I mean, as we should already be impressed by him, but like, I'm still impressed by him. I think that was a good idea to do this movie about him. And I like how Steven kind of like, how do I say this? He just admires Frank in a way, you know what I mean? And he really wanted to do justice. And I thought he did. Okay. Well, let me tell you something. The book says one thing and then Frank says something else. And I'm like, Frank, what is the freaking truth?
One thing I want to say, the book was written by him, right?
Yes.
No.
What? But it like literally sounded like
because he had a writer write it for him that he interviewed. He was interviewed by this writer by like four times. But so he says that about 80% of it is true, and a lot of it is dramatized and exaggerated by the writer.
One of the things I was seeing was they were like had an excerpt from the book, but then how it was written, the name, like obviously names, you can change names to also protect people. So I was like, that was different. Like they changed some of the names, and then how it was written also made it seem like it wasn't written by him. Because it was just like a small little excerpt that I found. And that's why I was curious.
Oh my God. This whole time I thought it was written by him. Well, anyways, there's two versions of this.
It was approved by him. How about that?
Okay. Well, let me tell you, I'll kind of say what was in the book. And then I also say what he says. But here is what's true. Frank Abagnale Jr. was born on April 27th, 1948. His birthday is coming up. To his French mother and Italian-American father. He is the third of four kids. He has two older brothers and a younger sister. So that part was different from the movie. And he does say that over and over again. Like, you know, I have siblings. I'm not an only child. So we know that's true. He was the only one, obviously, named after his father. If that doesn't tell you you're the favorite, then I'm not sure what does. So
he was the oldest, right?
No, he's not. I said he's the third of four. So
oh, third,
he's the second to last.
Yeah, my bad.
So yeah, like, I mean, it, I think that is weird that the oldest didn't get the Frank Jr. name, but anyways, it doesn't matter. I would say Frank had a typical all-American upbringing in the 50s. You know, he had very loving parents. They lived in a nice house. His dad did well financially. His mom was a stay-at-home mom. He got along with his siblings. His dad had his own business, a stationery business, which all the kids worked at one point. Frank said he did the deliveries. You know, it just, it sounded like a pretty happy childhood. And then boom, all of a sudden. So in the book, it says that around age 14, his father went on a boating trip. And this is something he did really very often. But this time when his dad went on a trip, his mom packed everything up, all the kids, and like moved them out. And so his dad came home to like an empty house and was like, oh, shit. And this other thing that Frank has said in interviews, so we know this is true, is that his parents hid the problems in their marriage very well because everyone was like super happy. They thought everything was fine. And then all of a sudden they're getting a divorce. So yeah, like I said, in the book, it kind of came off that way as well. The only difference is that Frank says in real life how he was at school and all of a sudden he's at divorce court. So it's like the movie, like all of a sudden he's at family court and they're like, what parent do you want to live with?
Yeah, that scene was so messed up.
No.
And I'm like, and the guy was like, it's not a big deal. Just write a name down. I'm like,
yeah.
Yeah, that's a big deal, bro.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I'm kind of wondering though, if they made like the way that they shot that scene was more in Frank's head than as the pressure really was though.
Yeah.
To just make it more stressful. I don't know.
I mean, I don't know. That is, I remember when I was younger too, the same thing almost happened to us and like me and my siblings, and they were going to be like, oh, we might have to go to like court and you have to like say whoever, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, I do not want to do that. Like, I don't want to do that. It's like, you're going to hurt someone's feelings. And then, yeah, it's just hard, but luckily we didn't have to, thank God.
Yeah.
I don't know who the hell I would have chose.
Yeah. I think obviously nowadays I have not heard anyone ever having, like, from people our age and younger, I've never heard of that happening again. It just seems like kind of an old practice that they did and realize it's messed up and the kids shouldn't choose. But Frank did go through that where he had to choose. And so, like I said, in real life, he says that he couldn't choose, so he ran away. But in the book, it says that, you know, he was 14, or like when this happened. So he was a lot younger, and he actually chose to live with his dad, because the other three kids went to go live with his mom, and he told his mom, like, I don't want to leave dad alone. And so his mom was like, okay, that's fine. She technically had custody of him, but she allowed him to live with Frank Sr. just because, yeah, I mean, it does suck that he went from, you know, having this full house to now nothing. So Frank obviously is close to Frank. So, you know, they had this special bond. Something else that was in the book was that they said that his father was like 28 when he met his mom and she was 15. And so Frank thinks that contributed to the, you know, the issues that they had, because like I said, she was a stay-at-home mom and I think she wanted some independence, and he is already this old, not old, how do I say this, kind of established guy. Like, he's already set in his ways. So I think, I mean, obviously that is a huge age difference. So I can see how, like, as she's growing up and, you know, gross. Coming to her own, it is gross. It is. Yeah. I was like, what?
I mean, it was different back then. But
Yeah, it was. I mean, this is what, like, gross. This is like the 40s. So
yeah.
The 40s. Yeah. So, and they did say, like, they met while he was in the military and he was in France. I'm going to move on to his first con. I'm going to talk about, like, what I read in the book. And it's that, so once he moved in with Frank Sr., he started hanging out with the bad crowd. And it's the crowd that kind of all have similar, what they're all going through something similar. Like, they're all coming from a divorced household. They don't know how to handle it. Things are changing. They don't like it. And I think, and so Frank kind of joined this because he kind of had that same motive of, like, if I get in trouble, my parents will have to come and they have to come together to help make me better. And maybe because of that, they'll get back together. I mean, I feel like it's every logic that a 14, 15 year old would have. So he started hanging out with them, even though he kind of felt like he was, well, since he looked older, or he did look older, that doesn't mean it made him more mature, but it did. He felt like what they did was hella dumb, immature, and he said it lacked style. And I'm like, okay, yeah, Frank, compared to what you did, it sure did lack style. So, for example, they stole a car, but they took it off of the driveway while the owner was watering his lawn. I mean, yeah, these kids. So Frank got in trouble and his dad used his resources to get him out of trouble and make sure that this is off his record. And so Frank felt bad after that. And so he kind of straightened up. He got a part-time job. He started going to school regularly. And then his dad was impressed. So he bought him an old Ford. And Frank fixed it up, you know, loved it, drove it around. And okay, so I was like, here's where things get spicy. So when he started driving it around, he started getting attention from the ladies. And it's like cringy when I was reading it in the book, because he's like really explicitly talked about how like he had this lust for the ladies a lot of times. But again, we have to remember he's this 16-year-old boy with hormones, and yeah, so like it's like awkward for me to read, but then, you know, I have to keep reminding myself like it's a 16-year-old boy. So now he's hot shit with his lady magnet and he loved it, but his part-time job wasn't paying for the bills, which is like, you know, things he needs, like gas for the car, the dates, whatever. So he needed a way to make more money. And he asked, because more money, it means more honey. Like, so dumb. What did I write, Lisa? So he begged his dad for a gas card, and it's like a credit card. I think gas cards still exist, but I don't know anyone who has them these days. But yeah, it's essentially like a credit card, but you just use it to get like gas, and you know, you could pay for it at the end of the month versus right there and then. So he's thinking in his head, if I use this gas card, I can save my money, use it for the date there and then, and then save up money for the end of the month and pay everything off the gas card. So his dad agreed. He was like, yeah, I trust you. I'm giving this to you. This, what I'm giving you, not only is my but you know, just like just my trust that you will pay it back because this is under my name. So Frank like took it seriously. But then after a while, he realized that this still isn't working out. He still needs money. He's still broke at the end of the month. So one day he drives by the gas station and there's a sign that says $160 for a set of tires and put it on your gas card. So before he saw that sign, he only could get gas with his gas card. He didn't think about buying anything else. So he goes up to the owner and talks about it a little bit. And then he said, hey, what if I buy the set of tires, but instead of you giving me the tires, you give me $100. And then at the end of the month, my dad will pay it back. So you'll get your money back plus an extra $60. And he's like, I don't know. And then he asks for Frank's ID and he sees that Frank's 16. Cause remember, Frank looks older. So he's like, oh shit, you're 16. You're still under the guardianship of your dad. Of course your dad's going to pay it back. I'm going to get my money back. So yeah, I'll do this. So he does this and he does this multiple times and he racks up a bill of $3,400. And what does a 16-year-old do when they get a bill of $3,400? They throw it in the trash and forget it exists. So he throws it in the trash. He gets another second notice, throws it in the trash again. You know, I think he gets another notice, throws it in the trash. And finally, they call Frank Sr. and they're like, hey man, you're a valued customer. And we see you have had a card with us for 15 years, but we have to ask. And this is how they wrote it in the book, because I thought it was cute. Just how in the hell can you run up a $3,400 bill for gas, oil, batteries, and tires for one 1952 Ford in the span of 3 months? You've put in 14 sets of tires on the car in the past 60 days, bought 22 batteries in the past 90 days, and you can't be getting over 2 miles to the gallon on gas. We figure you don't even have an oil pan on the damn thing. Have you given any thought to trading the car and getting a new one, Mr. Abagnale? And Frank Sr. is like, the fuck? You know, let me go talk to my son about this. So Frank Sr. goes to Frank Jr. and was like, tell me the truth and I will forgive you. You won't be punished. I just need to know, did you do this and why? And Frank admits, he's like, yes, dad. And here is what his response is in the book. It's the girls, dad. They do funny things to me. I can't explain it.
Oh my God. Wow.
And so he says his dad's response, don't worry about it, boy. Einstein couldn't explain it either. And it totally reminds me of the Marie Curie episode, because, you know, how she had a scandal and he also had a scandal. I'm like, all right, Einstein really couldn't explain it. He had his own things.
Just forgave him.
Yes.
The dad just forgave him.
Yes.
What the?
I mean, in the book, that's what they said. He just forgives him. He pays the bill. Like, after that, he's like, all right. And to be fair, I truly respect Frank Sr. for doing that, because he's like, I'm creating a safe space for you to tell me the truth. I'm letting you know that if you tell me the truth and admit to this, you know, all is forgiven. And he did that. So, he, you know, Frank admitted to it, told the truth. And his dad was like, I forgive you. And I'm going to pay this bill. So
heck no.
I know. I know. Like,
you better be working extra at my store to pay this off.
Yeah. I think that it just kind of, it just tells like, you know, the kind of father he is, you know, he just wanted to his son to own up to it, you know, versus, I don't know, lying to get out of it. But his mother, yeah, she was like, oh, hell no. So she sent him off to a Catholic school, an all boys Catholic school. And Frank was like, you know, it wasn't bad. It was a good school and everything. But the real punishment was there ain't no girls. So while he was away, things really started to change for Frank Sr. His dad lost his business. And so in the book, it doesn't say anything about the IRA, like how it does in the movie. It just says that his dad lost his, or, and also in the movie, it happens while they're, the husband and wife are still together. You know, in the book, it's saying it's separate. So he lost the business, as I said, 20 times, right? His car, both cars, his car and Frank Jr.'s car and the house. So now he lives in the small apartment. And when Frank Jr. came back, he was like really embarrassed. Like they were driving around in this old Chevy and he was complaining to his dad. And is like, are you embarrassed, dad? Like, and his dad tells him, it's not what a man has, but what a man is. That's important. And I'm like, man, he's a good dad. Like, I think that's, you know, that's pretty telling. And, you know, to say like losing, going from having everything to nothing and still saying that, I think that really shows where his true values are. And then in the book, it says like, you know, after all of this, like he, obviously it's like not the next day, but like sometime later, Frank Jr. woke up one morning, just decided to leave. Like he just thought like, this isn't where I want to be. So he just left. So that's the difference in the book versus the movie. So I'm just going to talk about a couple more cons before the impersonations. So the other things is that like when he left, he like befriended this kid and he convinced the kid to tell his parents that this is his friend. So he had a nice place to stay. I mean, I'm like kind of like that's sort of a con because they conned the parents, you know. Then he made it to NYC. And so while he was there, you know, he found this job and the job paid him, because he was 16 and he didn't have a high school diploma, they paid him $1.50 an hour. And then he learned, oh, if you're older, you get paid more. So that's when he was able to tamper with his driver's license. And in interviews, Frank does say he did that. And that actually the driver's license, they didn't have a picture at the time. It was easy to basically kind of tamper with. So he changed it from 1948 to 1938. So now he's 26 versus 16. And when he got another job telling them that he's 26, it went from $1.50 an hour to $2.75 an hour. But still, it's still it's less than what he would make if he had a nice high school diploma. I mean, like he's still not making enough money. He did have a checkbook. So when his dad sold his car, he opened a checking account for Frank Jr. and put the money he got from the car into Frank's account. So Frank had that money, but he tried to use that sparingly, only like emergencies, but obviously like that just kept coming up and coming up. So he realized that if he were to write a check to like whatever, one bank and not a huge amount, right? Like $5, $20, they wouldn't really like check twice. They would just give him the cash. And then like a week later, they'll find out that the check was bad. But by then Frank's already off with the cash. So he learned that, but obviously the checks were running out and he has his name on the check. So he knew that this is a short-term thing because they're going to go and find his parents later. So yeah, those were kind of the other cons. And all right. And I just want to like throw that there because I feel like the check thing is a pretty big deal. That's that really motivated him to do a lot of other things. So the last thing I want to talk about is his relationship with his dad. And I was like, I might get a little emotional, but you know, I think it's really, really important we talk about this because even Steven Spielberg himself made sure to show the relationship between him and his dad in the movie. So I think we have to do the same thing. So in the Google talk that Frank gave his speech at, he said something. Okay, so he says this and it's gonna sound kind of cringy at first, but we have to remember, like, you know, Frank is from a different time and he obviously doesn't speak this lingo, but he said, you know, like, in the speech, he says something like, oh, you're so lucky, you went to like all these places, you're a genius, da, da, da. And he doesn't think that of himself. He says the thing that he's the most lucky of is to have a daddy. And so that's where I'm like, a daddy. But he calls his dad daddy. And in his, the way it sounds like is that for him, a daddy is just a man, a very, very loving father. He said that every night his dad would come into their bedrooms, like all four kids, give him a kiss goodnight and whisper in their ear, I love you. And he would do this every single night, no matter the age, because he had an older brother who was like a college football player. And he would even go to that brother's room, give him a kiss, whisper, I love you every night. So it just shows he wanted his children to know he loved them. And again, with the whole like con and the $3,400, that's how much he loved his son. You know, he was like, tell me the truth and we'll fix this. Regardless to that, like Frank Sr. clearly loves his children, but the two Franks, Frank Sr. and Frank Jr., they just clearly had a very, very special bond. I don't know if it's the Frank name or something like that, but truly they did. Something that I think is kind of, I just didn't get the impression of from the book is that, because in the movie you see like Frank Sr. kind of doing a little, what is sort of like manipulation of his own. And in the book, it doesn't sound that way. Like Frank Sr., you know, he did have his own business and he was into politics and he would go out with the politicians in his town and have a night out with them, have a night out with the businessmen. He was like, in the book, he was saying like, I thought my dad was maybe like an alcoholic, but like not really, because he would be double fisting, but somehow still didn't seem drunk. But it's, but it's like, but to me, like it just didn't show in the book. It didn't sound like something bad was happening. It just, in the book, it more like sound like how he went from a man to having everything to having nothing, you know, and I wanted to put that out there because I just felt like that was something weird. I thought in the movie, I really was like, oh, maybe they're trying to get this, like, oh, when Frank Jr. would go with Frank Sr. to those little like business events or whatever, he's seeing his dad watching in awe, like kind of manipulating this guy or conning, you know, kind of where he got it from. But I didn't get that impression in the book. So I wanted to put that out there too. Last thing I wanted to say, oh, sorry. One more thing is that in the book, they also say that Frank Jr., like Frank Sr., would try to use Frank Jr. as this like middleman between the parents, because Frank Sr. really wanted his wife back. So he would ask Frank Jr. to kind of help instigate that, or just help him like get his mom back together. And Frank Jr. really wanted his parents back together. So he like willingly did this. Eventually it kind of, you know, he started to kind of stop doing it because he realized his mom just doesn't want to be back with his dad. And I think that was hard for him, but he started to notice like his mom was moving on with her life. She was going to school. She got her own job, blah, blah, blah. His dad, you know, I guess to his dying day, was trying to win his mom back. His mom never remarried. And the other thing is that in the movie, we see that he goes visits his dad a couple of times, and he says in real life that he never saw his dad again after he ran away, because his dad died in 1972. Frank was captured in 69, but spent all that time in prison, so he didn't see his dad. And I just thought,
so that differed from the movie then? The mom never remarried?
No, she didn't.
Or had a kid?
No, okay. She didn't remarry. Yeah, so
I didn't realize he's deal in the movie. Died.
I knew what? He like, that's why I knew he hadn't seen his dad or whatever, but I thought it was some other reasons. I don't know, it was because he died.
No, yeah, I think when he was out on the run, he just never had the opportunity to go back to see his dad. And yeah. Then I think he thought, oh, after my prison sentence is over, like I'll see my dad, or maybe or whatever.
That's right. Yeah, in the film, he did say that his dad died.
Exactly. It did happen exactly how they said it in the movie. Is that he was at the train station, he tripped and fell, and he just like mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's really sad. And when I heard Frank even talk about it in the Google talk, you could just tell it's still something that hurts. He still carries that to this day. But something I think that came out of it is that he also says that one of his joys in life is being a daddy. Mm-hmm. Like a little bit of a full circle.
That has to be tough, because I mean, you're over there doing cons and you like, he, yeah, like you said, he probably thought he had more time, but instead he's living this other crazy mm-hmm. life. And that's basically the reason why he didn't see his dad name.
Well, I
that's
think you tough. Never think that, like, speaking from experience, is that you think that you have more time. You think like,
yeah,
oh, I'll see them on this day. I have another week. Like, even me, I thought I had another 20 mm-hmm. years, but you know, these sometimes yeah. it just comes out of nowhere.
Oh yeah. Have you guys seen so totally different thing, but I was thinking about this like before you even started talking, I was just waiting. Have you guys seen pictures of Frank when he was younger?
Yeah, because like when he first started I hella wanted to see what he looked like when he was younger. One, because yeah. obviously they said he was 16, but he was pretending to be like 26. So I'm like, did he really look older? And two, just because when I was reading the book, you know, he just kept talking about how he had this lust for the ladies. So I was yeah. like, are you cute enough to have the ladies?
He was pretty attractive though. Yeah. I like looked and I was like, because I won't, me personally, I just wanted to look because I saw pictures of him now and I was like, he's like what, like,
well, he's know, like 70 whatever now.
Yeah, but I mean, like, he like doesn't 70. Look to me like he was someone who was like super attractive when they were younger or whatever. And then I looked and I was like, whoa, I was like, he was looking good when he was younger.
But something that was something for me that really throws me off is that, like, every time I see him in interviews or like whatever, he doesn't look like he's 6 foot tall. Like, because he kept saying that, you know, like, by the time he was like 16, he was 6 foot tall, da da da. So that's why he kind of looked a little older. But I guess because, like, in the 60 minute when he's sitting down, you know, in the Google Talks, like, mm-hmm. he's at a podium, like, no one's standing next to him. So you can't tell for sure. But that was something that threw me off. I was like, this guy's 6 foot tall.
Okay, so I'll quickly talk about the FBI agent,
yes.
Carl Hannerty, and if he was real. So yeah, the character Carl Hannerty is not a real life person. He is more of a mashup of a number of FBI agents who worked to catch Abagnale. However, one of the most notable FBI agents and the agent who was the head of the investigation was Agent Joseph Shea. I feel like even though they said that it wasn't really like based on one person, I feel like it was like, I feel like this is the agent, this guy Joseph Shea yeah. was the one that they were, I don't know, to me, like when I was reading it, I was like, okay, this seems like it was based on that guy, so I don't get why they're trying to say that it wasn't, it was just a mashup of people. But
in that thing, Frank says the same thing, he says that, like, Tom, when he saw Tom, he saw Joseph, like the mm-hmm. way Tom persecuted yeah. himself, it was Joseph.
I mean, so maybe he actually is. I don't know why, like, things I found, like, oh no, he's not real, that did, maybe just because the name, and they're like, he's actually and like all these people, but I'm like, but other things, I'm like, it sounds exactly like the relationship. I don't know. Anyways, Joseph Shea, he spent several years looking for Abagnale. He also acted as Abagnale's main contact at the bureau, similar to Hannerty in the movie. For some time, Shea had believed that Frank was an inexperienced criminal in his mid-30s, not realizing that his suspect was only a teenager. As well as in the movie, Abagnale and Shea also became friends, with Abagnale dedicating his book to him, which I thought was cute. I was like, ah. I don't know. It's also kind of funny just to think that, like, someone you're trying to, like, capture, and then you become, like, besties with them. In this interview that I found, he was asked, oh, why did you dedicate your book to this guy? You know, like, basically, like I said, like, he was trying to capture you, and then you guys became friends, blah, blah, why'd you dedicate it? And Abagnale said, he and I were friends for 30 years. He died at the age of 88, just about a year ago, at the time of this interview. He was a great help up until his death. I watched his two daughters grow up and get married. I attended their weddings. He watched my children grow up. He was obviously a big part of my life in getting me out of prison and getting me to work with the government. He was someone who saw that I had something to offer, and he was very big on helping me do that. I think when he started out, he thought I was some master criminal and he was going to catch me. But when he came to the realization that I was just a kid and I was a runaway, being a father, he had a lot more compassion. I was just like, touched my little heart. And I also think too, something that's like, because you know how he mentioned him being like a father figure, I feel like that's what he was, because his own father, you know, passed away. So I think he kind of took on that role for Abagnale and kind of helped steer him in the correct direction. That was pretty much all I could really find on this dude, because there's not even like his Wikipedia page, as we always say, we reference, had like literally like nothing on there. It didn't even mention anything about any of this stuff. But yeah, I just think really their connection and their friendship was what was like really sweet and kind of like, I don't know, just really touched my heartstrings, and that they were really good friends and stuff like that.
Well, yeah. And but he's also like an FBI agent, so I figured they really want to keep all that secret, you know. It's like, I bet anybody goes into the Wikipedia. Yeah. I'm just imagining,
because well, like- I wanted Because I wanted to, like, I don't know more about, like, his thoughts on whatever, da, 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 but it literally was just like, yep, this is who it was based on, like, da-da-da-da, and it was more of, like, Abagnale talking about him than, like, anything else I could find, so I was like, okay.
Yeah. It's the FBI. They've just erased all of it.
Yeah. I mean, that makes sense.
Well, because didn't he even have a different name in the book because he was, like, yeah, still doing FBI stuff at the time?
I think it was, yeah, oh, something. I think in the book.
I didn't get that far in the book.
There was something, like, because the section that I was talking about, how I found something of, like, a excerpt from the book, he had a different name. That's what I was asking. I was like, was it written by him or somebody else? Because it sounded like it was almost written in a way where, like, they changed people's names. And
yeah, because I think they said that most of the names in the book were their actual names besides his because of his work.
But yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. All right, so let's talk about his, well, expand on his impersonations and his cons that we see in the movie. But I guess I'll start with one that they kind of touch on, but they don't really expand on it in the movie. His fourth and phony career that was left out, but it was illustrated a little bit, was when he posed as the French teacher for his class. For one summer semester, Abagnale took on the role of a sociology professor at Brigham Young University in Provo, Utah. He was well-liked by his students, who found him affable and intelligent. He pulled it off by reading one chapter ahead of them every week, which some pupils found a little odd. BYU advertised in the paper for a sociology professor. Abagnale forged a transcript from Columbia University, and the prestigious university took him on. Carrie Jenkins of BYU said in 2003 that she and the staff found no record of his tenure at the school, despite Abagnale's claims that he taught a 90-minute course to a total of 141 students. Abagnale said that he couldn't remember which alias he used while working there, but despite writing is the author of his, I mean, he just calls it, like, what did he call it? He just says that it's a story about his life. He doesn't really call it a biography, because, like I said, the author kind of exaggerated some parts to make it more exciting. But despite Redding's penchant to take certain liberties with his story in the book based on his life, he was indeed on the campus during his spree. Whether he was a professor or a mere teacher's aide is up for debate, and it is possible that were he the latter, there would be no record of his stint teaching sociology. So that happened when I was looking into, like, all of his personas, like, that kind of happened quite a bit, where, because I think once the book came out, a journalist looked further into it, you know, to back up the claims, and couldn't really find, like, any of the info, like, you know, was he actually impersonating these people? To which he said, he's just like, well, obviously these companies, you know, Pan Am and stuff, aren't gonna own up to it, that they were tricked by a kid. Like, it's just like, why would they admit to that? So obviously you're not going to find anything. Which I thought was kind of funny.
I agree. Right, I can see like a school being like, no, like, we wouldn't exactly be tricked. yeah
pretty much.
And I've heard that before, that he read, like, a chapter before, but I thought it was, I didn't remember what it was, but yeah, I've heard that story as well, that he, like, read a chapter before the students.
Makes sense. I mean, I feel like teachers do that, real actual teachers. So the first real job that they show in the movie is him as an airline pilot. So later, Abagnale decided to impersonate a pilot to look more legitimate when cashing checks. He obtained a uniform by calling Pan American Airways, Pan Am, telling the company that he was a pilot working for them who had lost his uniform while getting it cleaned at his hotel, and obtaining a new one with a fake employee ID number. He then forged a Federal Aviation Administration pilot's license. Pan Am estimated that between the ages of 16 to 18, Abagnale flew as a passenger more than 1,000,000 miles on more than 250 flights, and flew to 26 countries by deadheading, which is, you know, flying for free, so that,
yeah, I had to look that
crew
up.
Yeah, so that the crew member would be at the right place for their next, you know, job flight. As a teenager, he noticed that his hair was graying, which he parlayed into his pilot persona by giving the appearance of being older and having more professional credentials than he did. As a company pilot, he was also able to stay at hotels for free during this time. Expenses such as food or lodging were billed to the airline company. However, Abagnale did not fly on Pan Am Airlines, believing his charade could potentially be identified by real Pan Am pilots or employees who would ask for genuine identification or proof of employment. Abagnale stated that he was often invited by pilots to take the controls of the plane in flight. On one occasion, he was offered the courtesy of flying at 30,000 feet. He took the controls and enabled the autopilot, saying, quote, "very much aware that I had been handed custody of 140 lives, my own included, because I couldn't fly a kite." So,
yeah, that's all the stuff that I, like when he was a doctor and all that stuff, when they were showing him kind of just like asking all those questions, I was like, bro, like that would be like too scary to pretend to be all these people with like these types of jobs.
I'll get into it.
Yeah. Like, oh my God, I would just be like a wreck. Like, like.
Yeah, because it's just like, at least the, I mean, at least the pilot one, he can be like, oh, I'm a co-pilot, you know, whatever. I'm just like flying to my next job type of a thing and never really take on the risk, I guess, unless there was like a super emergency where both pilots were incapacitated at some point for some reason. But yeah, when he became a doctor, I was just like, boy, what are you doing? That's danger right there. So for 11 months, Abagnale impersonated a chief resident pediatrician in a Georgia hospital under the alias Frank Williams. He chose this course after he was nearly arrested disembarking from a flight in New Orleans. Afraid of possible capture, he retired temporarily to Georgia. When filling out a rental application, he impulsively listed his occupation as doctor, fearing that the owner might check with Pan Am if he wrote pilot. After befriending a real doctor who lived in the same apartment complex, he agreed to act as a supervisor of resident interns as a favor until the local hospital could find someone else to take the job. The position was not solely administrative, as he once claimed, but was not demanding for Abagnale, as seven interns were eager to get experience under his supervision. He was able to fake his way through most of the duties by letting the interns show off their handling of the cases coming in during his late night shift. However, he was nearly exposed when an infant became critically unwell from oxygen deprivation, and he didn't initially understand the meaning or gravity of the situation when a nurse informed him of a, quote, blue baby. He left the hospital only after he realized he could put lives at risk by his inability to respond to life or death situations. So at least he, you know, had a head on his shoulders to be like, that was dangerous, time to change careers.
Yeah.
That is very scary.
I just would not be able to do that. So I'm like, dude, his shit that he did, like, how, like, I just would not be able to keep cool, like, especially, I don't know, I would just feel like I'd be like,
yeah. It's kind of like what he was saying in I think it was a 60-minute interview where he's just like, he doesn't think he'd be able to pull off all of this if you were like any, like, slightly any older, and he thinks that him being so young really worked to his advantage because he literally thought he could do anything. Mm-hmm. And didn't really think about
that
it
makes sense.
Just,
yeah
he just had confidence because he was 17 years old, and that's just
yeah, that, you know, and like, yeah, kids that age are generally more, a little bit more reckless than
definitely
older people.
Oh my God.
So his final job that they portray in the movie is him becoming an attorney. So while posing as Pan Am First Officer Robert Black, Abagnale forged a Harvard University law transcript, passed the Louisiana bar exam, and got a job at the Louisiana State Attorney General's office at the age of 19. He told a flight attendant he had briefly dated that he was also a Harvard Law School student, and she introduced him to a lawyer friend. Abagnale was told the bar needed more lawyers and was offered a chance to apply. After making a fake transcript from Harvard, he prepared himself for the compulsory exam. Despite failing twice, he claims to have passed the bar exam legitimately on the third try after 8 weeks of study because, quote, Louisiana at the time allowed you to take the bar over and over as many times as you needed. It was really a matter of eliminating what you got wrong. In his biography, he described the premise of his legal job as a gopher boy who simply fetched coffee and books for his boss. However, a real Harvard graduate also working for the attorney general, and he had hounded Abagnale with questions about his tenure at Harvard. Abagnale had trouble crafting a plausible story for himself as an undergraduate of a university he never attended, and the coworker soon became suspicious, repeatedly interrogating Abagnale. Due to his doubts about his credentials, the coworker had contacted Harvard in order to confirm Abagnale's academic qualifications. Finding none, he convinced his boss to launch a background check on Abagnale. However, Abagnale resigned before he could be exposed. He spent a total of 8 months as a fake attorney.
Dang, that guy was out
again. He's he peaced out. He's like, no.
That sucks. I feel like that attorney thing was like the safest one out of all of them. Like, he passed the bar, you know, like, yeah.
I mean, depending on who he was defending, or, you know, could have had like real world repercussions,
I guess. But I feel like if you have taken the bar, like, you, it's like taking like your driver's license test, right? Like, you start to know, you kind of have an idea of like what the rules are.
Yeah.
But oh my God, that scene though, when he was like in court or whatever.
I know. I love that scene.
There's no jury. There's no.
What are you doing?
Yeah.
So he was, I mean, they show what, he was arrested twice or three times and he escaped. I don't know. They showed he was arrested a couple times in the movie and escaped. But man, I was like going off when I was reading his Wikipedia, because this was just crazy to me. But like before all of this, when he was like kind of, I'd say smaller crimes in the grand scheme of everything that he was doing, he was caught and arrested in Eureka, California.
Oh yeah, I saw that.
Isn't that crazy? Ooh, Alex's gonna be. Yeah. I was freaking out. For those of you who don't know, that's where I was born and raised. Okay. But I found the newspaper clipping from when he was arrested. So I kind of wanted to read that because I just thought it was crazy. And there's a, maybe I'll send this to you, Nicole, for the Instagram, but there's a picture of him sitting in the back of the police car. And then they also have a picture of the car that he was caught driving in, which is just like, boy, why were you driving that car? Because it's so obvious. Like, they could identify you so easily. Anyway, so yeah, so this is an article. Yeah, this is from like the Humboldt Times or something like that. But it's titled Federal Charge for NY Youth. So this is Frank William Abagnale Jr., 17-year-old Mount Vernon, New York youth, was arrested here shortly after noon yesterday and charged with impersonating an employee of the U.S. Department of Immigration. After appearing before U.S. Commissioner Norman Cisna, he was certified to juvenile hall here and booked en route to the U.S. Marshal. So they like held him in the juvenile hall here in Eureka, which is so silly. Abagnale is scheduled to face federal district court judge Cheryl Halbert in Sacramento to answer to the charge. The complaint alleges he had claimed a tax exemption as a federal employee at the Imperial 400 Motel here. The situation was brought to light by City Police Sergeant Fred Somberg of the check detail on a route. Sorry, this is like, it's old, this newspaper, is I'm like trying my best to read it. On a routine investigation of a local checking account which Abagnale opened or attempted to open, Sonberg alerted the FBI resident agent Richard Miller and a description of the bright yellow late model Mustang with the which there's a picture of it. It's for some reason written on the like front side of it. It says Bandit.
Okay.
Which is just like, boy, why would you do that?
It's just advertising.
Yeah, so,
it now.
Yeah. So yes, it's a Bandit lettered on both front fenders. And Miller spotted the youth on Fifth Street shortly afterward, but lost him in traffic. Just like lost him in traffic. Eureka traffic. Hilarious. Miller then radioed police headquarters and an all units alarm was broadcast with the Arcata police throwing up a roadblock there. Sheriff's Detective Lee Templeton finally spotted Abagnale at Harrison and Myrtle Avenues and brought him to a halt. They also found a regulation police baton in his car. So
he impersonated a police officer at some point.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, yeah. So he was, yeah, driving a yellow Mustang with Bandit on the side of the, it's just like, you really weren't that's trying hilarious. Very hard. But anyway, so yeah.
That's fearless, you know, right there.
So I thought that was pretty dang crazy. It's just like, this town is so tiny. And yet this, you know, like this guy who fooled, I was going to say all of America, but he fooled some other countries too, of millions of dollars was caught here. But clearly it didn't, his imprisonment here did not last long because he went on. But so they showed this in the movie, even though it was kind of debunked by you know, several people that know one or two things about planes. But while being deported to the United States, Abagnale escaped from a British VC-10 airliner as it was turning onto a taxiway at New York's John F. Kennedy International Airport. Under the cover of night, he scaled a nearby fence and hailed a cab to Grand Central Terminal. After stopping in the Bronx to change clothes and pick up a set of keys to a Montreal bank safe deposit box containing $20,000 or $100,000 in today's money, Abagnale caught a train to Montreal's Dorval Airport to purchase a ticket to Sao Paulo, Brazil, after a close call at a Max Milk, which I guess is a Canadian store. I don't know. He was apprehended by a constable of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police while standing in line at the ticket counter. Subsequently, Abagnale was handed over to the U.S. Border Patrol. So he escaped a few times. Yeah, so what I was saying was, so the way that they showed him escape from the plane in the movie was that he, like, took the screws out of the toilet in the bathroom and, like, slipped past the toilet bowl or something like that. But, yeah, that's pretty much been debunked, and you can't do that. I mean, they're airtight, and I guess they're very heavy, so he wouldn't have been able to do that. I guess the real way that he got off the plane was using his knowledge of planes at this point, because he had flown so much, he escaped out like a kitchen entrance of like where they would bring the food onto the plane, passenger food. So that's how he actually got off the plane. He didn't crawl through
the
entrance.
It's way more dramatic from through the toilet though, okay?
Yeah. I know, and then you like how Tom Hanks is just like,
I know.
His legs are hanging out. Funny. I thought it was funny too, because he said in an interview, like, he was watching the movie with his wife, and she like turns to him, she's like, "You didn't do that, did you?" He was like, "No, honey, I didn't." Like, even his wife was like, "You do, like, what?" So, yeah.
Another alleged escape. So, in April 1971, Abagnale reportedly escaped from the Federal Detention Center in Atlanta, Georgia, while awaiting trial. During the time, U.S. prisons were being condemned by civil rights groups and investigated by congressional committees. And in a stroke of luck that included the accompanying U.S. Marshal forgetting his detention commitment papers, Abagnale was mistaken for an undercover prison inspector and was given privileges and food far better than the other inmates. The Federal Bureau of Prisons in Atlanta had already lost two employees as a result of reports written by undercover federal agents, and Abagnale took advantage of their vulnerability. He contacted a friend, called in his book Jean Sebring, who posed as his fiance, and slipped him the business card of Inspector C.W. Dunlap of the Bureau of Prisons, which he had obtained by posing as a freelance writer doing an article on fire safety measures in federal detention centers. So he had people on his side working with him. She also handed over a business card for Sean O'Reilly, later revealed to be the FBI agent Joseph Shea, the FBI agent in charge of Abagnale's case, which she doctored at a stationery print shop. Abagnale told the corrections officer that he was indeed a prison inspector and handed over Dunlap's business card as proof. He told them that he needed to contact FBI agent Sean O'Reilly on a matter of urgent business. O'Reilly's supposed telephone number, the number had been altered by Sebring, was dialed, and the call was picked up by Jean Sebring at a payphone in an Atlanta shopping mall, posing as an operator at the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Later, he was allowed to meet unsupervised with the FBI agent in a predetermined car outside the detention center. Incognito, Sebring picked up Abagnale and instead drove him to an Atlanta bus station, where he took a Greyhound bus to New York and soon thereafter a train to Washington, D.C. Abagnale then bluffed his way through an attempted capture by posing as an FBI agent after being recognized by a motel registration clerk. Intent on making his way to Brazil, Abagnale was picked up a few weeks later by two NYPD detectives when he inadvertently walked past their unmarked police car. So...
That's crazy.
Which I feel like, and maybe they used this a little bit, because he did, at least when he first ran into Tom Hanks, you know, bluff that he was the officer that was supposed to, you know, show up. So maybe they kind of took some of that from that.
Yeah.
Just like, he was always,
I was
just,
like,
you know,
when I saw that, I was like, how did he not get kicked off the case if that actually like happened in real life, you know?
But it's like it. But it's like if any of those people that were like doubting his capabilities as an FBI agent, if they were even to just like speak with him once, would know that this guy is just like a master of smooth talking and bluffing his way through anything.
Oh, one thing I wanted to say that reminded me when you were reading about his impersonations that actually I probably should have talked about when we're talking about his first cons. But one of the ones that I had read was that. That I thought was kind of funny and silly that people fell for it was that he noticed that a bank or something was like dropping off their like deposits for the night at like some thing. Yeah. And then he put the, out of order sign on it and was like drop off the deposits with the security guard. And it's like, and they were like, how could the bank deposit thing be closed or not working when it's like, you just drop the money in there? I thought that was hilarious.
It's just like, how could people be that stupid?
I mean, it's surprising, but I think people are also just used to just like not really thinking when they're doing stuff like that. They're just like, okay, whatever, da da da. Like, so I can see how it can happen, but it's also pretty silly that people do fall for that shit all the time.
Yeah, yeah. And I would say that it's like definitely a different time period because I mean, which I'll get into, you know, what he's doing now or whatever. And like in our, you know, time now, it's like people get scammed all the time. Like that's just a thing. That's just like common knowledge. You're always afraid of getting scammed by someone who's not saying who they really are. And it's like back then scams weren't really that big, like not the general public wasn't as easily scammed out of things. So it's just kind of, they probably were just like, didn't give it another thought. They're like, oh, out of order. All right. I'll just give it to this guy because he's a security guard. You can trust him. Like,
yeah, totally. And like now everyone's just skeptical of everything. I'm like,
exactly.
Yeah,
dude, that's no one can be trusted.
It reminds me of that episode in Friends when Monica got her credit card like stolen, or you know, and that somebody else was posing as Monica Geller and they were just like so impressed. They're like, oh my god, how did she do that? And then she went to go meet the person. And it's funny because I feel like all of us have probably gone through that like so many times where you have to get a new credit card or whatever, like close your account, and it's like it's crazy how like then they were like, wow, she must be so smart, she did that.
Well, I mean, it is kind of like a skill to be able to scam people like that, but it's just like, use those powers for good, not evil. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about his romances. As in the film, we see that Frank has many liaisons with women, and obviously this is one of his motivations for doing the cons. As Lisa said earlier, he had a thing for the ladies and they were kind of the driving force behind a lot of the things that he did. So yeah, he enjoyed the attention he was getting from women. And I wanted to see if the Brenda Strong character, that the one he was engaged to and married or whatever in the film, Amy Adams's character, if that was an IRL person or a person that was real. Yeah, so basically, because obviously she was a big deal to Frank, she was in the film, she was the one that he kind of actually revealed his real name to, and it seemed like he was actually for realsies in love with her, but she's not a real person. I think it's kind of, to me, it was like kind of similar to the whole Joseph Shea. I think she was kind of just based on people or someone that he met throughout his life, but it wasn't like exactly the same person. So she was based on an Eastern Airlines flight attendant Frank dated while living in Louisiana. They were never engaged because at the time, Frank says he was much too young to be thinking about that.
There was a nurse named Brenda, right?
Yeah, I don't think so.
I don't think he was like engaged to anybody, but I think that, in the book, because I got to the part right where he started becoming a doctor and there was a nurse named Brenda who like was showing him around the hospital. And that's probably like as far as I got. But again, we said that the book is not exactly.
Yeah. Sick. I mean, as far as I found, she was based on this flight attendant, so I don't know, and that he was never interested in being engaged at that time.
Yeah.
And so another scene that we see in the film was Jennifer Garner's character. I don't remember her character's name in the film, though. An actress or something, right? In the film, wasn't she? Or a model. She's a model in the film.
She's a model, yeah.
Yeah. So I guess a similar scene, something similar did happen in real life. So after negotiating a price for the night together and settling on $1,000, the girl convinces Frank that instead of going out to cash his check for four, so basically like the tire thing, Lisa, where it was like $106 or $60, it's like basically the same thing. So he endorses the check to her and she'll pay him the $400 difference. And then basically when she goes to cash it, she realizes that it's a bad check. And so she's upset because she was basically outed $400. And so from, this is the excerpt that I found from the book. So from his book, Abagnale says that after she cashed the check, the bank informed her several days later that the check was counterfeit. She was contacted by the FBI agents about it, and she was a little hesitant to tell him what really happened and why she got the check from Abagnale. But eventually she did, stating, "I don't mind his getting a free piece. Hell, I've given it away before. But that bastard conned me out of $400 cash. That I resent." I just thought it was funny. So yeah, those are the kind of the main ones I looked into, because those are like the actual character people. I was looking to see, obviously we already know he was very much into the ladies and whatnot, but there wasn't any other actual like stories I could find. But I did want to briefly mention his real wife as well, because this is the person who wasn't portrayed in the film at all, but she was also the one that he credits as turning his life around. And not really, he credits her more than like him actually being in prison and whatnot and dealing with all that stuff. So in an interview, he says, "It would be easy for me to say that prison somehow rehabilitated me or I was born again. But the truth is that I met my wife on an undercover assignment after leaving prison. And when it was over, I told her who I really was. Eventually, I asked her to marry me against the wishes of her parents, and she did. I didn't have a dime to my name, but she believed in me and didn't judge me on the basis of my past. She gave me three beautiful sons, one of whom, ironically, is an FBI agent today. And her love and trust is what turned my life around." I thought, oh yeah. So basically, I thought it was interesting because something else I saw was basically, yeah, she was working in the FBI or was a part of all that stuff. And I just think it's funny how his life has really turned around in that sense. He went from being all this like, you know, con artist to like being heavily involved with the FBI, dating or marrying someone who was involved in the FBI as well. And then now his son is also in the FBI.
I was going to say, you sound just like him when you read that, because he like says that, he has said that like a couple of times in his interviews, exactly like that.
Oh, really?
It's like, you sound, well, just I'm glad.
But yeah, I don't know. I think it's cool. It's like his life really has turned around for the better, it seems. But it's also kind of, I guess, yeah, well, a lot of times when I was reading this too, and I mean, we're going to talk about what he did for the FBI and stuff like that too. But at first I was like, that's not fair that like he gets all this shit after he did all these crimes. But then like you said earlier, he was also a kid at the time. Not that that excuses any of your past shit, but it's like he was going through a lot with his family. And I don't know, I think just trying to figure out his shit. And then like we said, he was also very swayed by his hormones, which I've talked to my husband. I asked him about the crazy shit he did when he was kid. He's like, "Hey man, I was like a hormone filled kid. I didn't know what the hell I was doing." And so I'm just like, okay, whatever.
He's like, it's the girls, Nicole, they do funny things to me.
Pretty much. I'm just like, bro, like why would you say shit like that? And he's just like, I don't know, I was trying to be cool, I was trying to do this, like whatever, just blah blah blah. And I'm just like, okay, I guess because it's like different, because me at that age, I wasn't doing shit like that. I was just like, whatever. But I guess that's just very telling. No. How men are just, yes, swayed by, dude, stuff like that. Like, come on guys, get a hold of yourselves.
Yeah, dude, like Luis will tell me stuff too and I'm like, what? Like, yeah, I was that same age and I'm still like Barbies and unicorns, you know.
Like, yeah, no, totally. I don't get it. I can't relate, but like I guess I can understand a little bit, but like
so I guess we will get into his legitimate jobs. Yes. All right, so in 1974, after he had served fewer than 7 years of his 12-year sentence at Federal Correctional Institution in Petersburg, Virginia, the United States federal government released him on the condition that he help the federal authorities without pay to investigate crimes committed by fraud and scam artists and sign in once a week. Unwilling to return to his family in New York, he left the choice of parole location up to the court, which decided that he would be paroled in Houston, Texas. After his release, Abagnale tried numerous jobs, including cook, grocer, and movie projectionist, but he was fired from most of these after it was discovered he had been hired without revealing his criminal past. Finding those jobs he was able to land unsatisfying, he approached a bank with an offer. He explained to the bank what he had done and offered to speak to the bank staff and show them various tricks that paper hangers, which is what they considered him, what they used to defraud banks. His offer included the condition that if they did not find a speech helpful, they would owe him nothing. Otherwise, they would owe him only $50, with an agreement that they would provide his name to other banks. With that, he began a legitimate life as a security consultant. In 2015, Abagnale was named the AARP Fraud Watch Ambassador, where he helps to provide online programs and community forums to educate consumers about ways to protect themselves from identity theft and cybercrime. In 2018, he began co-hosting the AARP podcast, The Perfect Scam, about scammers and how they operate. What he's up to now, and some of this Nicole kind of said, because that's just his life now. But according to Abagnale, it was hard to keep a low profile in a big city. He convinced his federal handlers that he needed to move himself, his wife Kelly, and three sons to Tulsa, Oklahoma. There he stopped making speeches and kept as low a profile as possible. He and his family lived in the same house for the next 25 years. His son enrolled in Monte Cassino School and Bishop Kelly High School, both private schools. After the sons left home for college and careers elsewhere, Kelly suggested that she and Frank should leave Tulsa. They agreed to move to Charleston, South Carolina. He later founded Abagnale and Associates, based in Tulsa, Oklahoma, which advises companies on fraud issues. Abagnale also continues to advise the FBI, with whom he has been associated for more than 40 years, by teaching at the FBI Academy and lecturing the FBI field offices throughout the country. According to his website, more than 14,000 institutions have adopted Abagnale's fraud prevention programs. Abagnale testified before the U.S. Senate in November 2012 about the vulnerabilities of senior citizens to fraud, particularly stressing the very common use of Social Security numbers for identification included on Medicare cards. So and now he continues to live on Daniel Island near Charleston, South Carolina, with his wife, whom Nicole said he met while working undercover for the FBI. They have three sons, Scott, Chris, and Sean. Scott works for the FBI. Abagnale cites meeting his wife as the motivation for changing his life, saying, quote, "She met me as someone else with a completely different background. And when the assignment was over, I had broken protocol because you're never supposed to do this. But I told her who I really was because I wanted to continue to see her. She accepted what I told her, and eventually we got married and have been married ever since." He now works as a private consultant, author, and public speaker with the goal of preventing fraud.
That was another thing that I think Frank said that Steven said about the movie. The reason why he really wanted to do it is not because of all the crimes or all the impersonations that he did, and not because he's the greatest con man in American history. I think that's his title or something like that. But it wasn't because of that. It's because of what Frank has done after the fact and how he turned his life around, and how, you know, Steven loved that aspect of the story more so than the thrilling lifestyle he had before that. And I think that's what I personally kind of was drew to as well. It's really interesting how he was able to turn his life around. Or have I been conned as well?
I actually have the part where he talks about the movie being exaggerated. I guess I should have put it elsewhere, but like I said, when the film came out, Abagnale posted a message on his website acknowledging that it would probably have some exaggerations because so did the book it was based on. The memoir's co-author, Stan Redding, interviewed Abagnale about four times and did a great job of telling the story, but he also over-dramatized and exaggerated some of it. "He was just telling a story and not writing my biography," Abagnale said, and the book had a disclaimer indicating as much. Abagnale wrote that he was honored to have Spielberg, DiCaprio, and Hanks make a film inspired by his life, but added, "It is important to understand that it is just a movie, not a biographical documentary." Still, he later told an interviewer that the movie and subsequent stage musical based on it were about 80% accurate. So,
yeah, I think I thought about the 80% thing.
Yeah. All I was going to say, if you guys have time, I would recommend you watching that Google talk, because after he talks about like his life and stuff like that, he answers some questions, and some of the questions that they asked are pretty good. Like, I mean, one of the questions I was like, man, that was a really good question. It was, how do you deal with imposter syndrome? And I'm like, oh man, yeah, that's the guy to ask. Okay. So I was going to say, like, it's really interesting the way Frank answers questions, and kind of shows that even in the interviews, it shows that he kind of has this way of dominating a conversation, because even with the questions, he doesn't like directly answer it. He kind of goes off and it seems to veer off for a minute and then it comes back to answering it. So I'm like thinking to myself, like, he's a true manipulator, because he makes sure that he like, I think that if there's a part of a question he didn't want to answer, he clearly distracts your mind from it. Anyways, with the imposter syndrome answer though, he definitely said that he didn't have it because he was such a young kid that it was never a fear of his, or he never had that syndrome. But his only answer was to that was just to believe in what you're doing, because the second that you have any doubt, everyone else is going to doubt you as well. And I was like, all right, man, haven't heard that before. But anyways,
I was just, you saying that question though actually was like, I don't know, interesting too, because it's like, I feel like not his life is defined by the stuff that he did when he was a kid, but it's interesting that he has spent most of his life working against fraud versus when he was actually doing the fraud. So it's like interesting that like all of this gets brought up a lot for him, and you know, he's asked questions about it, or you know, like things are constantly made about it when it's like that was a smaller portion of his life versus everything he's done now. But like, mm-hmm. I don't know, it's just interesting that everyone's more focused on that. But I think it also has to do with, obviously, because there's a movie about it and all this other stuff. But
yeah,
that's interesting. Yeah.
And probably just, I mean, it's just crazy that this kid so young was able to do all of this. It's just like, yeah, how was the system that this kid could just do this? Yeah. But now it's, you know, he helped fix it and it's better than ever, I guess. Yeah. But
well, I think like, whatever, stick it to the freaking big guy, because like, Pan Am, like they could afford paying for one extra, you know, kid, because he says all the time,
well, like, could they?
I guess you're right.
They ultimately went bankrupt and no longer exist.
True that. But to me, at least, I'm thinking this kid, he was just thinking about surviving at the end of the day. It was never like this malicious, like, I'm trying to get back at you. It's more like, I just need food and I need a place to stay. And I need money for the ladies. But
like, it's a bit more than that, though. But
what do you mean? He wasn't like, trying,
I mean,
to, like,
I mean, hello. He's freaking doctor and shit, like being doing doctor shit. Like, that's like potential to put people's lives in danger. So, I mean.
Oh, I guess you're right. Well, what I meant is that he wasn't trying to do like some sort of like terrorist attack, you know?
Yeah.
By like.
Well, yeah, yeah. I think it started off as like what you said, but it kind of morphed into something more once it's like, you know, like once you get away with one thing, you're like, oh, let me see how far I can push it. And then you just, I think that's how it also kind of, what is it, goes out of control, or like, you
well,
know,
he did say, out of control. Oh, I guess he didn't.
Yeah, I was going to say, I have a quote about it. That he said, I mean, his reasoning is that he said, quote, it begins with my parents' divorce and its dramatic effect on me. I ran away and suddenly found myself a teenager alone in the world. I had to grow up very quickly and become very creative in order to survive. But what started out as survival became more and more of a game. I was an opportunist. So when I saw an opening, I asked myself, could I get away with that? Then there was the satisfaction of actually getting away with it. The more I got away with it, the more of a game it became. A game I knew I would ultimately lose, but a game I was going to have fun playing until I did. So
yeah, and that definitely seems like a child's mentality. Yep, too.
It definitely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
does it, I can't remember if this was in what, in my research and what I was reading, or if it said in at the end of the movie in the little blurb, but I was seeing something that said that out of like the $4 million or something, he had like $2 million that he didn't spend, so he mm-hmm. gave it back, and then I guess he like paid the other half back or something like that. Yeah, in his new career, which I thought was I thought that was interesting. That
I don't think
like,
that was at the end of the movie, was it?
Okay, so it must have been in my research so. Then
yeah, he did say that he said like multiple times that he's like paid his debt, or his dues, I guess is the right way to say it. Not his debt, his dues, because he also mentioned the $2 million that he had. He was like, I'm a kid with $2 million, like what am I gonna do with that money? I had no need for that money. I just had money. And so
yeah. And I'm sure it's like hard to conceptualize that much money at that young of an age too. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of money,
especially for the time period.
Yeah, I was gonna say that time period for sure, because he's getting paid $1.50 an hour like when he first ran away. God, so you can crazy. Imagine. Yeah, I know. Yeah. Even in the movie, when they would have moments where they were like, when Jennifer Garner was like $1,000, you know, it's kind of, I think, like, you know,
he
in
like
our terms,
stops and it's just like $1,000.
Yeah,
so much money.
Yeah, exactly.
I take $1,000. Shoot.
Yeah, but she was trying to like consider herself as like worth so much, you know. And it's like,
yeah, she was like trying to call his bluff, kind of.
Yeah, like, yeah, exactly. Wouldn't. And then, there was another thing where somebody asked him, how can I prevent like identity theft nowadays? And they were asking also like, is it easy to do now? And Frank's like, much easier. It's so much easier to commit these crimes now. And I'm like, what? But I'm sure like it probably couldn't go on as long as it did for Frank. You know, that, how long was it? Like 4 or 5 years it went on for?
That was like 6 years.
Six? Holy crap.
Yeah, I think it was 6 years.
Yeah, I'm sure somebody can do it, but not that long. Yeah, and then, probably but I thought that,
Because then you say like the main factor now is like technology and just like the way technology is, it's just like, it's easier, but you'll be caught faster.
Yeah.
Type of a thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He was like saying how like, he's like working with this company to try to get rid of passwords. And I'm like, dude, I freaking love that. Cause cause he's like, oh, at the bank, he said that bank companies, they spend millions of dollars on the call center, and most of the calls that go to the call center are resetting passwords. And so,
oh my God.
Yeah, I was like, what? And so he was just saying like, it's just dumb to have a password. Like I don't know what the alternative is. I guess that's something.
Not only that, everyone uses the same password over multiple platforms too. Yeah. That's not good either. So it's
Yeah. And then majority of the time, it's not like we're going and doing some complicated password, right? We're like doing something we can easily remember.
Password 123. In the year you were born.
And then he like talked about using credit card. He said like debit cards are like the worst invention. And I'm like, what? Like, that is just crazy to me. But it's really interesting, like hearing that from somebody like him. And you know, I think like they say he's like, or he, when they're like, you're such a genius, and he's like, no, not really. I'm like, no, Frank, you freaking are, dude. Like, pretty fucking badass, man. So yeah,
I was saying, a lot of these people who like scam and like are like forgers, like I feel like they're pretty smart. Like, you have to have some type of knowledge on something to be able to do that stuff. So that's what I'm saying, like, just use those evils for good instead. But
like Frank.
Oh yeah. And then one thing I saw that was kind of funny was that he liked that Leo portrayed him, because he's like, now when people think of me, they're going to think I looked like this guy.
Apparently his sons disagreed with their casting choice.
Oh, really?
Oh, really?
Yeah. I don't know if all three of them did, but definitely at least one of them.
Why did it say?
No, he didn't say. He didn't say. He just said that like his son disagreed with it. Hmm. I mean, I wouldn't. It's kind of like,
I know. I was like, I'd be happy if I was a dude, that if Leo was depicting me.
Yeah. No. Do you remember what's that doctor's name? And they just did the SNL skit with Brad Pitt. He said that he wanted Brad Pitt to portray him.
Dr. Fitt.
I can't say his name.
Fauci or whatever.
Fauci. There you go. I thought it was like something else. But yeah. And then they're like, oh, who would you want to portray you? And he said Brad Pitt. And then Brad Pitt did portray him in SNL. And so, yeah, it's like that.
Thanks for joining us this week on The Internet Historians. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts. Follow us on Instagram and subscribe to us on YouTube. Next week, we'll be discussing Ron Woodroof from the movie Dallas Buyers Club. So don't forget to tune in. Thanks again. We'll see you next week.
Bye.